listening to a special podcast recorded at the Royal Institution of Great Britain on February 12th, 2013. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, a weekly news magazine program about interesting things, from science to politics to culture, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion on poddelusion.co.uk. This is a podcast of the debate on Science and the Dark Art of Persuasion, held in the Faraday Lecture Theatre. Dr. Helen Zersky and Marcus Brigstock chaired the event, with speakers Dr. Felicity Meller, Professor Bruce Hood, and Professor Barry Smith as panellists. It was a lively debate and took many questions from the audience, which are also included in this recording. So here is Dr. Helen Zersky introducing the debate.
Hello, well done for coming along. I'm glad that I've been at least persuasive enough to get 420 people to turn up and think this was a good way of spending an evening. If you would like to tweet about this event, there's wireless here, so you should be able to do that. And the hashtag is DarkArts. So please feel free to tweet away and have your own little argument as all this is going on. But don't forget to join in the debate with all of us. I thought about this because I feel that up till now, it's been very easy for scientists to live in their little ivory tower and not really necessarily interact with society or deal with things in the same way that the rest of society does. And so it's been relatively insulated from things like persuasion, persuasive techniques, marketing, that kind of thing. And suddenly, with the rise of the increase in importance of science, which is fantastic, suddenly scientists are being faced with these situations where they're being asked to market themselves, where persuasive techniques are being used against their arguments. And I feel that we're walking into a bit of a minefield. You know, I feel that there's all sorts of things that are going on here, and if we don't think about it, we might make mistakes we would later regret and we wouldn't learn from them. So this, you know, I thought about, I think there's a lot I don't know. I'm a research scientist when I'm not on TV, when I'm allowed to do research. And so I feel I'm kind of at the sharp end of this. How should I behave as a research scientist? And so my solution to what I should do about what I don't know was to organise a debate, to get some fantastic expertise and a load of people in a room, and let's have a think about what we all think about these issues. And one of the problems with panels is that they can never be large enough. So I'm hoping that the tiny bits of expertise that are not covered by our amazing panel will be present in this room. So everyone's, when we get to the debate, everyone's opinion is very welcome, because you're all members of the public, you're all part of society. You know, this matters for you as well as it matters for me as a research scientist. So we want to hear all those different views. But we do have a fantastic panel. We have Bruce Hood, who some of you will recognise, most of you I'm sure will recognise as the RI Christmas lecturer from 2011, right? Not this year, the one before. Who's a cognitive scientist and thinks about how the brain actually works, what's going on inside your skull. We have Marcus Brigstock, who I'm sure many of you will know from Radio 4 and other places, who is very opinionated on lots of things. He's not a scientist. But he cares about the issues that science has to raise. And so he's here representing that side of the spectrum. We have Felicity Meller, who's a senior lecturer at Imperial. And she teaches as part of the science communication course, she teaches narrative, and she'll be talking to us a little bit about the ancient art of rhetoric, which is how the ancient Greeks and so on persuaded people of their views. And last but not least, we have Barry Smith, who's based at UCL. You seem to move about a lot. No, not at UCL. Somewhere in London. Anyway, it's me told. His background's in philosophy, I think, got that right. And he's interested in perception and how we perceive things. So these are our expert panel on how, you know, to tell us something about how persuasion might work. And the format will more or less be this. Each of us will talk for 5-ish minutes about whatever it is we have to say, and then we'll have a debate for an hour, guided by some questions. So if you've got questions as we're talking, hold on to them till we get to the bit with the debate, and then we've got people with microphones who will walk around, and if you have a microphone, everyone will be able to hear you. So I'm going to start with my little bit. There's a clicker. Where's the clicker? Here. So the first question, I think, so I wrote this title, Science and the Dark Art of Persuasion. And the first question somebody asked me is, why is persuasion a dark art? Which is a fair question, because we might not normally think of persuasion as being a bad thing. But I came across a quote I really liked from Immanuel Kant, which said, rhetoric is the art of playing for one's own purposes on the weaknesses of others. And I think that is possibly where persuasion that we would consider acceptable drifts into persuasion that we might not consider acceptable, when it's playing on someone's weaknesses for your own benefit, and not for the, you know, the larger benefit or whatever it is. But humans persuade all the time. This is part of being a human being. There are things that we respond really strongly to as good things. We are persuaded by them. And these are some of them, right? It's astonishing when you start to look at... I'm well aware that if I really want to publicise physics and make people think physics is a good thing, all I really have to do is physics with kittens. Because no one will ever say a bad word about a kitten. There's a quote, there's cuteness is nature's devious way of getting you to look after your offspring. These little things are devious. They have great big eyes and they're furry and they're cute and they make you want to feed them and pet them and generally look after them, right? So this is probably the acceptable end of persuasion, something we wouldn't consider looking after a kitten as being a bad thing to do. We're happy for the kitten to persuade us that it's cute because we can all go, aww. So this is all right? But I kind of feel there's a scale of persuasion, and this is my attempt at a scale of persuasion. So the kittens over there, kittens are probably okay. Anyone in the room who's going to admit to not liking kittens is a very brave person. Kittens are over there. Here we have Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. Those little white lies that we sort of tell, and they convince kids to have medicine they need and that kind of thing, and that's probably okay. Okay-ish, the World Wildlife Foundation and every other charity going uses the fluffiest possible animal as their emblem. And so even if, it's not really about the panda, it's about the bamboo forests that support the panda or the bigger ecology. People use the panda as an emblem. So that's sort of okay-ish. This is a tobacco advert from 1950-ish, which I couldn't decide whether to laugh or cry when I saw it. Lead women around by the nose, it says, implying that if you're smoking your pipe, women will, for some really weird reason, follow you around. But that's not really okay, because even back then, they knew of the health problems associated with smoking. So that's, it's an obvious association that you want women, therefore if smoke attracts women, then you want to smoke, even though they knew about the problems with it. That big oil should support local schools, that was something that an American company put up. And it's really interesting because it's kind of saying, big oil in little letters, that's okay because it supports schools. Let's forget about the pollution and the destroying of environments and the whatever else. It's okay because they support schools. And then this was apparently the biggest lie of last year. Romney said he used some, in his campaign against Obama, he made a statement which was absolutely false. Even he agreed it was not true. But he kept saying it in his campaign adverts. So I feel there's a scale of persuasion here. And the thing is that we live our lives somewhere on this scale. And this is humans, right? So we accept that some things are okay and some things are not okay. But if you're a scientist, is this scale the same? Do you have a different responsibility as a scientist? Do you have to sit? Do you have a responsibility to sit at a different place along this line? Is what's okay for you the same as what's okay for everybody else? Especially when scientists are losing debates to rhetoric. Other people are further up this scale into things that might not be okay, but they're winning debates using those techniques, and science is losing on topics that matter, like climate change and vaccination and so on. So I feel that as scientists, we should at least understand what's going on. We should understand the tools that are being used against us. But should we ever use it ourselves? Is it ever justified for a scientist in a debate to use a kitten? I don't know. That's what we're here for. So I feel there's a lot of issues to explore here. There's a lot of different situations where scientists may or may not say or do things in different ways. And this matters not just to scientists, but to all of society, to all of you. So there are probably no clear answers. And some of the things we do come across might make you feel quite uncomfortable. But this is the framework for this debate. I would like us to discuss how much scientists should be aware of this and how much they should use it themselves. And so I'm going to hand over to the next one along here, which is Marcus.
You're up. Now, right, good, okay. Thank you very much, Helen, for that and for inviting me here today. I don't normally get nervous, but that's because usually I'm fairly certain that most of the audience I'm playing to are not much cleverer than me. This might be different. Just so you know, I was described as being opinionated. They're not opinions, they're facts the world is yet to be persuaded by. I've got mixed feelings about this. I have very, very, very little proper scientific knowledge. There's one particular thing I've involved myself with, which is climate change, which might be up the sharp end of what we're talking about because it's a thing that's debated very, very often. Now, in the dark arts of science and the dark arts of persuasion, we're here having a discussion. Who amongst you are scientists, by the way, just by show of hands? Okay, very good. So there's a fair few scientists amongst you. The people, if, for example, we talk about climate change, who would oppose the information that you present to them wouldn't do this. So you're already screwed. They wouldn't bother doing this because it doesn't matter to them where on the Kitten versus Romney lie scale they sit. It's irrelevant to them. And so when you attempt to take those people on in the media, you're up against people for whom that scale means absolutely nothing whatsoever. It's irrelevant, and they wouldn't meet like this because there would be no point, because the ethics, as far as they're concerned, are neither here nor there. And in fact, I suspect if you talk to Mitt Romney, I wouldn't recommend it, but if you had to talk to Mitt Romney, I mean, it wouldn't even be over a cup of tea. He doesn't drink tea. I mean, for goodness sake. Mitt Romney could, I don't know, I have no idea, this is an idea, but I think Mitt Romney could feel fairly safe in telling you that the lie he told was worth it in the same way that the kitten is worth it or the spoonful of sugar is worth it, because he was serving a greater good. And whilst what he said about Jeeps being made in China and not being made in China might not quite be perfectly true, the thrust of what he was saying was far more important. And that, I think, is what science comes up against. I went on two occasions to the Arctic with some climate scientists and a bunch of artists. And the idea was that we worked with the scientists and then took the information and presented it in such a way as to make it more appealing. The organisation's called Cape Farewell. They're a fantastic organisation who I like very much. And I think it's been almost wholly ineffective. I hope I'm not tooting my own horn here, but of all the artists that were there, probably had the best opportunity, because what I do is work with words and usually make people laugh. And when you laugh, you feel warm and fuzzy and you're quite receptive to the message. I've made people laugh talking about climate change. I doubt I've persuaded anybody who didn't wish to be entirely persuaded already that the information that I gathered in the Arctic was of any use to them. You know, I sort of, the way I did it was by talking about a series of anecdotes that took place. Helen, you said when you were talking about this, about a minefield that science might be walking into, and you said we might make mistakes which we might later regret. That's exactly the difference between science and the media, of which I'm a part, so I'm not condemning them entirely. Just to demonstrate this point very quickly, just the scientists, would you raise your hands again, please? I'm looking for somebody who looks particularly smart. Spectacles, sir. You have glasses on. What's your name?
David.
David. And what stripe of scientist are you? You work in usability. Very good. Okay. What does that mean? I mean, I know what it means, but for the people here, assuming some of them don't.
So I'm interested in making interfaces easy to use, easy to learn, hard to forget.
Right. Okay.
Software
interfaces. Okay. This might be a difficult. I might have picked, because of your glasses. Thank you very much. someone. Okay, David, well, we can try this. Do you believe in man-made climate change? Do you believe the assertions put forward by the IPCC, broadly speaking?
At this time, yes. If you want a yes or no, yes.
I did want a yes or no, and you've given a yes. Okay, so you think that that climate change is happening, that it represents a threat,
yes.
And that it is in some significant part man-made.
Yes.
Prove it. Prove it.
Take a long time.
Well, we haven't got a long time. Prove it now.
Okay, I've been absorbing an awful lot of information, and I guess I can't prove it.
Right. Sorry, David. What? What's your surname?
My surname.
Yeah. David. What?
Bell.
David Bell. Okay, is that Dr. David Bell?
No.
Okay, all right. Scientist David Bell said at the Royal Institute that he could not prove that climate change that he'd previously claimed he believed in. He said at the Royal Institute today, can you write this down because I'm tweeting this. A scientist at the Royal Institute today said he cannot prove that climate change represents a real threat, having previously made the assertion. You idiot. I'm sorry to have picked on you. It's very unfair, but I hope it amply demonstrates the point that they don't care. They don't care. The facts are not important. The facts are not important. If you haven't already done it, look at the Daily Mail front pages on anything. If you do read the Mail, read it from Monday and stay with it till Friday. Okay, read it for the entire week, because the thing that will give you cancer on Monday will cure you by Friday. The people who get unhappy are the ones who just read it briefly. But that is, I think, what you're up against. I mean, Tom Utley, who's a Daily Mail columnist, I've probably gone way over, I'll be very quick, I promise. Tom Utley, who's a Daily Mail columnist, wrote a long time ago about climate change and about ice melting. And he said, I'm sitting at my writing desk with a glass of gin and tonic in front of me. It has ice cubes in it. And as they melt, they displace the same amount of water in their frozen state as they do in their liquid state. And therefore, in an entire page, I conclude that the melting ice caps represent no threat to us. And at the very bottom, he put, unless any of the ice that's currently on land melts, in which case we may have an issue. But I seriously doubt anyone had gone that far. Anyway, I'd never even gotten to page two, but I hope I demonstrated some points. The only other thing worth saying, because I just love to say it in this room, is that all of the things about the funding for the people who say that climate change is not happening that I asserted a long time ago and got my ass kicked for, saying the money comes from oil, it does. It does. The chain is so short, and that's the brilliance of the lie. The Koch brothers, it's only just come out this year, have been the big drivers in the American funding system, and Monckton, a swivel-eyed crook, and Nigel Lawson and so forth do it. Oh, and James Dellingpole knows that climate change is real and that it's man-made, and I heard him say that, but I can't tell you where. You just need to know that that's true. Thanks.
To frame the what we know about persuasion and how it works, first up we have Felicity Mellor.
Thank you, Helen. Well, when we agreed the order in which to speak, of course it didn't occur to me that I've got the worst slot coming after the funny man who can tell you hot stuff about what the climate sceptics really think. As Alan said, I'll say a bit about the nature of persuasion, of the study of rhetoric, which, of course, is what we're basically talking about here. So I hope you don't mind if I structure what I say around two rhetorical questions. My first question, which I think is part of what we're addressing today, is should scientists use the art of persuasion? Answer, yes. Of course. They already do. They have no choice. They have to persuade because they communicate. And if they are having to persuade, then they should be informed and intelligent about how they use this persuasion, how they set about persuading. So why do I say scientists already do that, already use persuasion? Well, because scientists have to communicate, and at some level, all communication is persuasion. Anything that is expressed with some sort of intent becomes an act of persuasion. So I come here tonight with no particular agenda, but I have to take some sort of position because that's the way these things run. And so I'm essentially seeking to persuade you that my view on this issue is correct. And even if I don't manage that, I at least want to persuade you I might have something slightly relevant to say here, and maybe even something a little bit interesting. So I'm here engaging in an act of persuasion. Scientists do the same. Scientists have to communicate. Data does not speak for itself. Data is meaningless. Data's just data. And it's only once you start talking about that data that you imbue it with meaning and it becomes a theory and it becomes science. So that act of communication is absolutely at the heart of science. And every scientist is trying to persuade. When they talk about their science, they are trying to persuade someone. It might be just a colleague, or it might even be themselves. They might be talking to themselves. But they are trying to articulate the mess that they see in the material world. And in doing that, they are having, of course, to use words, to use language. And as soon as you start to use language with some sort of intention to make sense of the world, you are engaged in rhetoric. So scientists, even in their own internal communications, are, I was going to say skilled rhetoricians. Maybe they're not skilled rhetoricians, but they're rhetoricians. They are using rhetoric. For instance, one of the most well-known devices within rhetoric is metaphor. We use metaphor in everyday life all the time. Poets use metaphor to great effect. Scientists use metaphor. Science is riddled with metaphor. You can hardly get through, you know, 1 minute of talking about science without using metaphor. Some examples of metaphor in science are perfectly innocent. So let me give one such example. Physicists talk about the spin of subatomic particles. When they say spin, you know, we imagine a little object whizzing round and round. But that is not what subatomic particles do. The spin is a metaphor. It's a metaphor to say this object, whatever that is, this entity, has some property that has just two possible values. Just like a spinning object might go clockwise or go anti-clockwise, so it is with a subatomic particle. But the subatomic particle does not actually spin. And it has other features which are not the same as a spinning object. So, for instance, you can't speed up the spin on a subatomic particle. It's either that or it's that. And it's a binary thing. There's no other options. So that notion of spin in subatomic physics is a metaphor. And it's a metaphor that's absolutely riddled through the science. It's a metaphor that's helpful because it gives us a way into talking about something that simply does not, you know, that we've got no common experience of because it's such a tiny little thing. So it's helpful. And it helps as we begin to learn about subatomic physics. But it's also limiting because it makes us implicitly think of this little spinning object, and that's not what we're talking about. So physicists have to sort of unlearn some of the connotations of that metaphor in order to become good physicists. So metaphors are there in the science, and they're limiting, but they're also, would say, generative. They produce meaning. Now, spin is a pretty innocent metaphor, as I said. Others are less innocent. So let's take another example. For instance, when we talk about DNA or the genome as the book of life. Now, that again has some use. It's a helpful thing to say. It, for instance, might enthuse undergraduate biology students that what they're doing is really important, that they're beginning to learn about the book of life. It's useful also because it allows us to think what we might do with DNA. So we start to think, well, if it's like a book, then we can copy it and we can reproduce it. We can maybe rewrite it. We can maybe even write our own version of the book. So we can start asking questions and thinking about what research we can do with DNA by having that metaphor, that sort of textual metaphor of the book of life. But of course, the Book of Life, before we had genetics, was something that we associated with religion. The Old Testament talks about the Book of Life. It's where God writes down, I think it's the list of everyone who's going into heaven, something like that. So for those with a religious sensibility, the Book of Life has a whole load of other connotations. And for the scientists to claim that what they're doing is writing the Book of Life is an act of great hubris to someone with religious sensibilities. So whilst that metaphor is useful in some contexts, it can become an obstacle for other audiences. So, scientists are engaged in rhetoric. They have to be. They cannot begin to do their work without using rhetorical devices. But in order to, as soon as you do that, you have to then think about, how does that rhetoric work? And one of the important things that people who study rhetoric talk about is about the one of the means of persuasion is to relate to your audience, to know where your audience is coming from. So in the Book of Life example, you know, that might work for a class of undergraduate biology students, but it's not going to work for a room full of Christian fundamentalists. It's going to annoy them. You need to know your audience. Now, of course, all scientists, everyone knows that. You know, scientists know that if they're speaking to a public audience, they can't speak in quite the same way as when they speak to an audience of their colleagues. They'll know that they need to use different language, they need to leave some things out. Now, they do tend to focus on the idea that to address a public audience, you need to sort of simplify the information. But The lesson of knowing your audience goes much deeper than that. It's not just about simplifying. It's about being able to make a connection and seeing that just having the information will not be enough. The content of an argument is not sufficient. We can't just shout louder and louder about climate change, for instance, and make any difference. It's not a lack of information that prevents action on something like climate change. And as an example of this, let me ask you all a question. How many of you believe that we do need to take some sort of action to limit carbon emissions? Right, just about full house. How many of you drive a car? Quite a lot of people.
Hypocrite.
If you believe that it matters about emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, there is a source of emissions, therefore you should stop. Now, of course, people have good reasons for not doing that, that it's difficult to live in this society without a car, and there's lots of other reasons why people continue to drive as well. The point is that the information is not enough. I'm sure Marcus understands, he's already told us, he understands the science of climate change. It's not enough to make a difference to personal action because that information comes in a much wider context. So to be successful in the art of rhetoric, one needs to address one's audience and understand what context they are in, what things they value, and what things are therefore obstacles to behaviour change. And I'm sure this is something that the other speakers will come on to. Another quick example about how addressing the audience makes a difference. One year, as I think Helen said, I run a course in science communication at Imperial College, and each year we get our students to just go and do something creative. You know, we say, just go off in groups and do something creative. So one year, a group went off and made some posters, which they put up in a large council office next to the lifts. And they were trying to persuade people to take the stairs instead of the lifts, because it's good for you. So the first poster they put up was very nicely designed. It was a very attractive poster with information about how taking the stairs would be good for you. Be good for your heart, it's good for your brain functioning, stuff like that. An authoritative statement, nicely presented. A few extra people took the stairs that day, but most got into the lift. Then the next day, they put up another poster. This poster had a picture of a lift with a great big hairy monster poking around the corner, and it said, "There's a monster in the lift, take the stairs." People took the stairs. As Marcus finds, you know, being humorous is one way to at least capture the attention of the audience. Now, those people who really just could not be bothered to take the stairs still got in the lift, so you're not going to get to them. But by using humour, for instance, that's one rhetorical technique, you manage to address your audience and, for some of them, produce behaviour change. So it's not about giving the information. The information does not help. So, my first question then, if we go back, and I'll finish quite soon, should scientists use the art of persuasion? Yes, they should. Second question, though, should they use the dark arts? Answer, no, they should not. By dark arts, of course, we mean manipulation, we mean deception, we mean dishonesty, even if that dishonesty sits on the scale from kittens to Mitt Romney. I guess the kittens aren't really being dishonest, but somewhere along that scale, dishonesty kicks in. And I think that's the thing that scientists should not do. They should not even be seen to be manipulative. Because the third thing that makes up the art of persuasion, we've got the content of the argument, we've got about knowing your audience, but way back with ancient Greeks, Aristotle said there's a third thing as well. And the third thing is the credibility of the speaker. And for Aristotle, the credibility of the speaker was about the character of the speaker, about their virtue. And it's not just about whether they're really a virtuous person inside, but whether they can demonstrate their virtue in their acts of persuasion. As soon as you get into the manipulative end of the rhetoric scale, then you risk losing your credibility, because if you're seen through, if you're seen to be cheating in any way, or even have doubt cast on you, which of course is what happened to the poor scientists at the University of East Anglia, then you lose credibility and all that great persuasive work you have been doing up until then becomes worthless. So no, scientists should not be using the dark arts. I'll leave it at that.
Bruce.
I'm going to follow up on some of the points that Felicity talked about, the audience, knowing your audience. When I got the invitation to take part tonight, I readily said yes. And it's not because Helen is particularly persuasive, though I suspect you can be. No, it's just I, probably like you, don't like to disagree. You know that experience that when someone asks you a favor and you have to decline it, you do feel a little bit uncomfortable about it. And so this is what I'm going to talk about tonight. It's something in our biology, something in our development, which just makes us easily persuadable. Yes, the content is important, but there is just something us as a pro-social animal that we just like to get on with other people. In fact, not only do we feel bad about it, but it registers in our brain as unpleasant. So if you put someone in a brain scanner and say, okay, I want you to disagree with a statement, the same regions which register pain and disgust, the anterior cingulate cortex, if you're interested, they also register these responses. It feels bad. And conversely, when you do something which is done with no particular reward, if you're acting altruistically and agreeing and just being pro-social, your reward centers are also firing away. So, in short, it's good to agree and it's bad to disagree. It feels bad. Now, another aspect I want to tell you about tonight is the extent to which we are easily persuadable. Okay, so there's work by psychologists like Francis Flynn at Stanford, who works on people's likelihood to agree to take part or give up something. So he typically, he will consult for charities, and charities are in the business of persuading people to give up resources or give up money. So in his studies, he sends people out onto the campus, and he says, I want you to stop people and ask them to fill out a questionnaire, okay, or give them your mobile phone, or give up their time to take you and show you where the library is. And these studies are very unpopular because people don't like to ask strangers for favors. We feel really uncomfortable. In fact, we don't like asking for help if we don't feel that we're in a position to reciprocate. It's in our nature not to do that. So we overestimate the unpleasant nature of saying no. And we underestimate the likelihood that people will help. So, for example, if you had to stop five people to get them to fill out, you know, a questionnaire, people estimate that it'll take, you have to stop maybe 20 or 25 people. In fact, it's much less than that. It's about 10 people. If it's their mobile phone, again, it's the same ratio. Every other person will lend you their phone or even give up their time to show you where things are on the campus. So this is really quite surprising. Maybe not in London, and I do agree that there are differences. But we are very pro-social animals. Now, of course, you can increase the likelihood that someone will help you out by kicking in with the mechanism of identifying with your audience. Or if you get them to just give a little favor, you know, a little, this is called the foot in the door technique. If you get them to sign a petition, they're much more likely to give you money later on when you ask for things. If you press a flower into their hand, as the Hare Krishnas discovered in the 1970s, people will then donate more. So the more you ingratiate yourself with your target, the more likely you are to get them to help out. So it's something about resonating with the other person. And this is where the brain science has been very instructive. We now know that when you're kind of thinking about yourself, you have areas of your brain, if you're interested, it's the medial prefrontal cortex or the temporoparietal junction. Doesn't really matter. These areas are activated when you're considering who you are. But they're also activated when you're thinking about someone else and imagining someone else's position. And the extent to which these same regions resonate in activity, they predict highly how much you're likely to help them out. Now, this is something that the people in marketing know very well. It's called the identifiable victim effect. Charities know that you are going to give more money to an individual if you associate yourself or identify with them. You're more likely to give more money to a single person rather than to a group of anonymous people. So again, it's this connection, forming this connection and seeing yourself, putting yourself in their shoes. And of course, this is cynically employed by politicians. If they want to persuade you of an argument, they'll tell you about Mrs. Bloggs they met the other day or Mr. Bloggs, and then they'll give you all this background information to try and make you get the backstory towards it. So again, it's this extent to which we see ourselves as putting ourselves in someone else's position. You can improve that by mimicry. You know, if you simply copy someone's behavior or you smile when they smile, or if you want to increase your tips as a waiter or a waitress, simply repeat the order back to you, back to the person as they're making the order. As soon as you hear these sorts of imitation, we immediately feel very pro-social and are more likely to agree with another person. And this all works very well unless we identify the other person as being an out-group member. Then the mimicry becomes mockery. And there you become very sensitive to the fact that you're being manipulated. So there's been 50 to 60 years on persuasion. We now know that people are easily persuadable. But now the neuroscience is showing why we're so persuadable, because we're a pro-social animal. So we're not so much a naked ape, but a persuasive ape.
And last but not least, we have Barry.
I was delighted to hear from Bruce as a fellow Scot that it's so difficult to disagree with someone, and I realise he was actually born in Canada. This is like Scots with confidence. It's very scary. You should try living in Glasgow. Disagreement's just fine. But I want to talk about a slightly different sense of persuasion. So we've heard about words persuading, we've heard about rhetorical devices, and we've even heard about the feeling of how we like to agree with people. These are all very conscious, understandable things that are rationally persuading us, or sometimes because we're weak and feeble, they persuade us in other ways. But nonetheless, it's coming into the conscious mind. I want to look at ways in which persuasion can go on under the radar, outside of consciousness, and still have a very powerful effect. But in raising the issues, I want to muddy the waters with the other speakers, because I think it's very easy to set up this debate by saying, here are the noble scientists doing their work, showing integrity. They don't manipulate, they don't mislead. And then there are the devious people, the marketers, you know, the manipulators who take this science and use it to bad effect. I think things are slightly more muddied, and I want to get you to think about that a little bit. Here's a nice case to start with. It turns out there are certain aromas in shampoo that make your hair feel softer. Who'd have thought But that sort of green apple smell that, you know, you're used to and appears in lots of shampoos, it actually has an effect. By the way, we process the interaction between smell and touch in the brain to make the fingers seem as though something soft happens. Now, it's not that this was something discovered and happened upon by, you know, evil marketers. This is a very important piece of science, as Bruce well knows. This is a case where we learn that the senses are much more interactive. They don't appear in their separate parcels. They don't give you information one by one. They interact. So touch and smell works, and marketers know it. Also, they can use it to maybe slightly misleading effect. Have you ever got one of these packages? I'm not going to say it's this company, but imagine a company just like it. You have one of these packages at the supermarket that contains little capsules that you stick into your washing machine and you hope it's going to make your clothes clean and fresh. They smell wonderful. And you think, oh, that's obviously going to lead to clean, fresh clothes, because we know that if you get the odors and aromas of fresh, clean, floral smells, you're going to think the clothes are cleaner, they're softer, they're whiter. The capsules cannot be smelling because the liquid is sealed inside them. Where's the odor coming from? And the answer is, it's coming from that strip that you have to tear off the packet to open it up. In fact, if you kept the box, it would smell longer of that smell than your clothes will. So here's a way in which, you know, clever marketers, knowing that odor has this effect on our perceptions of freshness and cleanness, are using it. Now, that seems like manipulation, bad stuff. Here's another piece of work with a friend and collaborator, Charles Spence, a psychologist from Oxford, who got the Ig Nobel Prize for his work on potato chips. He did some fantastic work with Pringles. They're a dream to an experimenter because they're all identical. So you don't really have to worry and control for variation. What he did was he fed these hungry undergraduates fresh and stale Pringles. You leave the Pringles out of the box for a day, not very good. People eat them, they say, they taste stale. But it turns out when you've got headphones on and you're listening to the high-frequency sound of your own crunching, they taste fresh. Okay? Now, that's scientifically, that's interesting, because again, who would have thought that sound had an impact on taste and flavor? Again, it's a sort of sensory connection we hadn't anticipated. So this is important. But of course, he did this work for Unilever, and that's why they make the bags so noisy. So when you're sitting annoyed in a cinema as somebody's rustling their way through a very noisy bag, that's because it's trying to get the brain to think freshness. It's trying to give you expectations that are going to control the experience you get in your mouth. And of course, anybody who works with science and marketing knows you're not interested in the constitution of the product. You're interested in the experience of the product. So anything that has an effect on the experience matters. So is this manipulation, misleading, distorting? I think it's distorting. I mean, if you think your crisps are fresh when it's just because you've got sounds or headphones on, that's manipulation. But of course, there are other effects of these interactions which we might wonder about as to whether they're manipulative in a bad way. Are they illusions? Are they actually just part of perception? If I gave you a stick of vanilla to smell, I'd say to you, what does it smell like? And you'd say, smells sweet. Which is interesting, because sweet's a taste, not a smell. See the modal interactions already? Very multi-sensory here. So if I give you a piece to bite, you would find it was quite bitter. It's not sweet at all. But it turns out that if I give you something to eat or drink, and I give you vanilla aroma with it, it will taste sweeter. This is called the sweetness enhancement effect, and it's very robust. Even if you know about it, you can't turn it off. So in a way, that's good, because why is vanilla one of the most popular ice cream manufacturers' flavors? Because you can use less sugar to make it, because when you've got the vanilla aroma in there, it's going to taste sweeter without using so much sugar. That's a kind of benefit if you don't want to deliver so much sugar in ice cream. And then look at, so you might wonder, is this taking advantage or manipulating people, or is it that it's a normal part of our perception of flavor, that the aroma of vanilla increases sweetness, and therefore sweetness is just part of the perception of flavor, and many senses contribute to it? Well, there's a slight kink here in that vanilla smells sweet to people on a Western diet. It actually smells salty to people on Southeast Asian diet who've never had Western food, because they don't mix vanilla with ice cream and custard and biscuits and cake. They mix it with salty foods and with fish. So it's culturally specific. How about another piece of manipulation, another piece of work by Charles Spence, who I'm sorry to pick on in this context, but he does lovely work, lovely experimental work. And notice experimental work is often manipulating people. I mean, you've got to get it through the ethics committee, but you're often trying to slightly manipulate people. The scientists know what that's like. You're often manipulating people because you're learning something science needs to know. Here's something interesting. You take two bowls of yogurt. They've got exactly the same yogurt in each bowl, but in one of the bowls there's a little weight at the bottom. Now you hand the yogurt to someone and say, test that. And then you hand them the other bowl, try that. Which yogurt is creamier, richer, thicker? This one, right? Now that's interesting, because although you might think, oh, well, then you're manipulating people to choose a yogurt which isn't actually richer, creamier, thicker. But of course, it's a way in which you can get people to eat low-fat yogurt and still enjoy it. So that might be a health benefit. But equally, it's the case that the brain is always doing this. The brain is always using many signals simultaneously from many different senses to come up with an expectation of what's going on around it. So, of course, it's going to be very vulnerable. And it's going to be vulnerable in the way that if you get in there and change some of the impacts and the variables, you can have a different experience, or you can persuade people that things are going on which are not dangerous, manipulative, misleading. Well, let me end with a case which I think is we would like to think of as good manipulation. We should cut down the salt in our diet. We should all have less salt in our diet, for sure. And Bruce, if he spent any time in Scotland, knows that we should all have less salt in our diet, because we've got the worst, and on the West Coast, we've got the worst heart rate record in the world. In fact, one year, Glasgow stopped being the foremost dangerous, highest incidence of coronary heart disease in the world. And they were told, you came second. And the Glaswegian said, who came first? And they said, well, it's the Polynesian Islanders. And he said, well, fight them. So we should have less salt in our diet. Now, here's this wonderful piece of scientific manipulation. Turns out that what makes something salty is how many salt receptors on the tongue are simultaneously touched, right? So, of course, you need a lot of salt to touch many receptors to get the salty food. But nanotechnology is trying to create molecules of salt which will unwrap themselves and which will sort of go into a star shape and therefore touch many receptors simultaneously. So you could use a quarter of the salt that you actually have now and still have, as it were, the same experience. That would be good. We would benefit. Manipulation? Misleading? Maybe. But it might be good manipulation. Thanks.
So we've heard lots of different takes on persuasion, and so now it's time for us to debate in general. And I thought, so we've got two microphones, roaming microphones somewhere down here, and there's one up on the balcony there. And I thought, I've got some examples to sort of guide the debate. Actually, this isn't one of them, because I've remembered something when Felicity was talking. I remembered something, and I'd like us to start off with this as an example of, you know, I want you to tell me whether you think this is the right thing to do or not. So I worked a few years ago in Rhode Island. There's a lot of people there who work on hurricanes, and they were very concerned that people were not prepared for hurricanes in Rhode Island. It's a long way up the East Coast. They were convinced a big hurricane was going to hit. These people were not going to be ready. They put a lot of effort in trying to convince people to have their little kit, you know, ready for the hurricanes. And nobody listened. And then one day, a scientist in NOAA, somewhere in D.C., came up with a brilliant idea. And they ran a campaign saying that the zombies were coming. Everybody made that. The number of people who had a hurricane preparedness kit for the zombies, because it was the same thing, went up by a factor of like 100 or so. Now, what do you think? Was that a valid thing to do? If a scientist sees something like that, is it valid to tell the public the zombies are coming? Because it has the same outcome. It has the protective effect. What do we think about that? One at the front here.
That does address the problem, which is scientists, when they communicate among themselves, their opinions are based on the scientific method. When you communicate with non-scientists, you're talking to people often whose opinions are based on faith. And therefore, scientists are trying to persuade them that they need to base their opinions not on faith, but on scientific method. Perhaps we should be looking to change not opinions, but behavior. Because it doesn't really matter what somebody believes, as long as they're doing the right thing, in the example you've just mentioned.
So is that a general view? Do other people think that it's okay? It doesn't matter why people believe what they believe, as long as they do the thing that we believe is the positive outcome. Does it matter? Nobody's very sure. Oh, there's one up the top somewhere. There's one up there and one up there.
Whilst we're waiting, can I just chip in there?
I think the problem when scientists speak is that they never speak in absolute terms. They speak in statistical language because science is typically one of probability. And that's something that lay people don't appreciate or really understand. It's something that you have to be taught. This is part of the scientific method, is understanding likelihoods. And that's why you can't say with any definitive answer that eating X is going to cause Y. And that is unfortunately just, you know, par for the course.
It's where people take away theory, they think it's theoretical.
Exactly. Well, yes, and of course, just for the record, a theory is a proven hypothesis. They should be saying hypothesis, but you try saying hypothesis on BBC One and you're never going to get anywhere.
So we had a question up the back there somewhere.
I have the microphone up here. Hello. You've kind of just answered it, really. I just thought the scientific method is about sort of disproving the null hypothesis, not about proving the hypothesis.
Exactly.
So if you don't have an end point, how can you persuade people towards it?
So does that mean we should give up on persuading the public of anything to do with science at all?
I can't answer that one.
There was another comment or question on this side, was there?
Yeah, I thought it was a good point that you made about changing people's behaviour rather than their opinions. But a recent example when the government health spokesman said that there wasn't really a problem with eating this meat in burgers because they thought it was more of an issue of fraud than danger. But they didn't actually know because they hadn't done the research. So I think the concern is you've got to be able to trust these people who are giving you advice. And if they say there are zombies coming and later you discover there aren't, then the next time they say something, you can't trust them or their organisation or perhaps another organisation that replaces them.
Barry, did you...
No, I was going to defer to
you. I just want the point about the zombies... I would guess that the people who then prepared for the hurricane didn't really think zombies were coming, but it had engaged them in a way. So, I mean, in that example, I don't think it's about sort of deceiving someone. It's not about their opinion being wrong. It's about the humour of the zombies. It gave a way in to make a connection.
Okay, I will come in, because I was going to say something I thought you had talked about earlier, and that was the character of the person speaking and the credibility of the person speaking. So, I mean, it may be true that, you know, that the meat that you're getting now in your lasagna is, in fact, horse and not beef. And it's not so bad that it's horse, because there are still horse butchers in Paris, so you can go and have a perfectly red horse tartare in some restaurants. But it's the fact that somebody had to deceive us about it, and therefore you're not going to trust that everything else is okay. It might be, but it's enough to have one trial of thinking this person misled me about some factual matter to be put in doubt of other things. And I think that must be true of scientists too. If anybody just tips you over the balance, you're going to say, not again.
I feel there's something here. I was thinking about this and thinking about adverts. And I feel that we watch adverts and we're more tolerant of... being manipulated because we think we know we're being manipulated. So it made me wonder whether there's something that says, if you tell someone you're about to be manipulated, it's kind of okay. Are we more accepting of that? And the times it really upsets us are when we thought we were in control and we weren't. Someone.
What I was going to say,
Could you wait for a microphone just for a second, just so everyone can hear you?
All I was going to say about the zombie in the same way as putting the monster in the lift
is that nobody thinks that there's going to be a monster. And what you're actually doing is everyone is buying into the disbelief of the motif that you're putting to the fear. So actually you're dispensing with doubt. So you make the choice for people to make very easy. You make it a yes or no rather than a grade of probability or faith or fear or whatever it is. So it's no longer an act of God. It's a bit like the zombies under the bed. Everyone knows it's not a zombie. It might be a communist or it might be whatever it is that you choose to fear at that
Don't
time.
Tell the Americans it might be
but
communists
it is it's making a commonly acceptable motif of fear or aspiration or whatever.
So let's just move on to this slide that we have up here, which is something I found in The Guardian, I think, just before Christmas. And the headline was, extreme weather is more persuasive on climate change than scientists. And there was this sentence that somewhere down the bottom in quite small letters that the people felt they were persuaded by personal experience. So here's a question which is actually quite common for climate scientists, is that we've been measuring weather and climate for a relatively short period of time. The science more or less says that we expect, in general, extreme weather events to become more common, but we don't know whether this specific one was due to climate change. But if it helps convince people that generally climate change is probably happening, is it ever justified to use a big storm as a vehicle for convincing people to do all the things that might mitigate climate change?
Dorothy used a hurricane as a vehicle.
Is that okay? Because it happened in The Wizard of Oz. somebody
just,
up at the top, up
there.
Yes, no, I don't think it is, because obviously if you engage in deception then and that's discovered, then they're not going to trust you in future. But can I just refer back to a previous question? And that's, what's the role of fear in persuasion? You know, with the Nazis in Germany and people ending up killing the Jews, how much of that was fear? Once it started, how much of it was self-deception? In a sense, people can convince themselves of almost anything. But that seems a major thing to have occurred in terms of people's thinking in psychology. And what are your views on the explanation of that?
In many ways, the Holocaust was a major incentive to kickstart research into persuasion. And indeed, some of the biggest names, Solomon Asch, Milgram, they were American Jews. And they were funded very much by the Jewish associations, trying to come up with an explanation of how people could do this to each other, how they could willingly, you know, create such atrocities. And what Milgram, you're probably already aware of this, demonstrated very reliably, and it's been repeated many times, is that we're all capable of doing it. In his original experiment, these are the experiments where they asked members of the public to administer lethal electric shocks. And before they started the experiment, they asked psychiatrists, how many do you think would actually do that? And the psychiatrists just took the incidence of psychopaths, around about 1%, said maybe about 1 in 100. In fact, it's 3 out of 4 people will do it. And that's been repeated every 10 years, that experiment. It's very reliable. So in other words, we are incredibly compliant and obedient, given the right context. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that shifting. It's in our nature to do what we're told if we perceive the other person to be an authority figure.
Bruce, I want to just be a little careful about we're all capable, because I'm very interested in the 25 or 23% who didn't do it. Right. And I hope they're around when I need it. Because, it really is, again, you said we have to, it's likelihood, you know, of a population, a lot of people will. But there are some people who want, and interestingly, in the case of Nazi Germany, you know, the common story is that many people didn't do it because they feared something would happen to them, and a lot of people who refused to commit the atrocities were just sort of sent off to some, you know, isolated place and nothing actually happened to them. So there are some, and we kind of hope there are more of those.
There's a statistical significance that people will do it,
right?
But not everyone.
That's it.
Actually, there's an alternative explanation for what you're describing, and it's the Zimbardo experiment in prisons. It's actually repeated on television by Steve Reichner at Glasgow and Alex Caslon in Exeter University. They accounted for the phenomenon you're talking about in research in terms of social identity.
Yeah.
where the prisoners' group rated a far greater intensity around resisting the incarceration punishment than the guards could. And the same type of process can be applied to the Holocaust thinking. In fact, a lot of Riker's own motivation is he's from a Jewish background himself and is very, what should I say, powerful in his research about the social identity mechanisms, not just the cognitive but the neurological ones. And that's what I think is missing from this discussion. There's been no mention at all, for example, of branding. And that could account for many of the phenomena you're talking about, both the use of metaphor and the thing about the climate change, because even the very notice on the screen there can be interpreted as the branding around climate change, which can be partly interpreted, I'd suggest, in terms of social identity.
So branding is something we're very used to in society. Is it something that scientists are justified? Let's bring this back to science a little bit. I don't want to debate Nazi Germany for too long. Branding is something that is acceptable if you're selling margarine and all kinds of other things. Universities are just starting to jump on the bandwagon of branding in a really serious way. And that means
with
they're pushing.
Videos.
We want
with Gangnam videos mostly.
Yes, well, they're not always doing it with taste, are they? But never mind. I have no particular opinion about that. those videos. But is it so? Do scientists? Is there a sort of a problem here with it? We're talking about credibility and the value of credibility. But once you have a brand that wants to smooth everything over. Make it all look nice, control an image. Is there a problem there? Because the university wants its very strong brand, but the credibility of an individual who stands out against the crowd may then be under threat. Anyone got any? One over here?
I wanted to sort of get on Marx's side against
Felicity's apparent reticence, and it's being voiced a number of times, where scientists don't want to speak up because they don't want to go against the grain. But if you read the Daily Mail, you would have forgotten by Friday. So I wonder whether they're oversensitive, because we have strong evidence that the incredible volume of information that people who connect with devices day in, day out. Yesterday's news is history, and it's forgotten very, very quickly. So should they be that concerned? Should these scientists be all that worried about running very close to the wind? Because if they read the papers on Monday, they're not going to be very popular. But come Friday, actually, they'll be fine again. And the zombies will be good for our health.
I'm fascinated by the zombies and the monster in the lift on a number of levels. So that it was unintentional. Unintentional, but it leads me to exactly the point I think I'm trying to make. You can watch my brain churning here. If you tell people there's a monster in the lift, they find it quite sweet and funny. They know what you mean and they take the stairs. If you tell people there's a monster at the front entrance, so they're best to go round the back, they'll walk further and they might also think that's sweet. If you tell people there's a monster at the on the road that leads to it, so they're best actually to get out of their cars and go all the way around, they'll get really pissed off. And science in that instance will need to create some very scary monsters. You'd have to go a lot further than someone peering around the lift door. You have to you're engaged then in the dark arts, which all media is. All media is a form of the dark arts. It's just a question of some high quality, some low quality, depending on where you approach it from. But you'll have to make an awful lot of monsters to continue to affect behaviour over the long run. And I think that's really dangerous. I think there is a wolf, and the boy who's crying wolf with regard to climate change, I happen to believe him. I've spoken to the people. I think there's a wolf there. But you keep shouting it. It won't make any difference whether there is or there isn't. I don't know if that's helpful, but it occurred to me.
Yes, I think there's not actually. You suggested there's some sort of disagreement between me and Marcus.
I think it's when you call me a hypocrite. So.
Surely you'd agree with that.
No. It's a hybrid car.
My position is that scientists are engaged in persuasion anyway. So, yes, they should be persuasive. But I wanted to draw some sort of distinction between an intentional dishonesty, intentional misleading, between that and an authentic attempt to persuade people of what you truly believe to be the situation because of your understanding of the science. And in that case, I think, yeah, scientists should get out there. I think we need to be a little bit careful. We're talking here about science as if it's some sort of single body. And, of course, within science, there are many different people with many different opinions. So there's questions about who, on whose behalf a scientist speaks when they speak. But if they've got something that they're passionate about and they feel needs to be addressed to the public, then yes, they should be going out there and they should be using well-crafted techniques to address the audience. And the point I wanted to make about the monster in the lift was, you know, one technique is humour. And that's why it's really good to have Marcus, concerned about climate change, because he can inject some humour into that debate and engage audiences that might otherwise not be reached in that way.
So how do you deal then with the fact that, say, you have a scientific principle which you are 90% certain of? Because that's how science works, right? That's what we do. We look at evidence and we say our best guess of what's going on is there's a 90% chance that it's this thing and a 10% chance that it's this thing. So in general, if you were going to bet, you'd bet on the 90%. Now, your credibility comes from being honest about that, because 1 in 10 times you're going to be wrong and that's going to be demonstrated. So do you still go on about the monster in the lift in the 90% case?
I think it depends on the situation. So if we come to the Superstorm Sandy, so that's a sort of probability. We don't know for sure that that storm was caused by global warming. What we do know is that global warming will cause events like that, and that is an event like that. Therefore, the experience of Superstorm Sandy is a genuine insight into climate change. And so I don't think we should be pussyfooting around saying, well, maybe that particular storm wasn't caused by climate change, but another one might be. I think that's just irrelevant. There is a truth to the experience of Superstorm Sandy informing our opinion about climate change. That's a truth. It might not be the truth that that storm was caused by that process, but there is a truth there. And so for that reason, we should be out there saying that sort of thing.
So some people in the middle over there somewhere up at the top, I think, saw some hands.
Has someone already got the microphone?
Yeah, if you've got a microphone, speak to it.
Yeah.
Hi there. I've got lots to say, but I'll try and keep it short.
Keep it reasonably brief.
I suppose you're right about the sort of there's no sort of definitive right and wrong in a lot of examples with science. And a lot of people draw on personal experiences, as you said. So, you know, you could say smoking's bad for you, but someone might say, well, my gran smoked all her life and she was fine. So is it really a case of maybe moving away from trying to persuade people what's definitively, you know, right or wrong, and perhaps focusing on the behaviour change? And, just a small anecdote, I saw there's a great little
That's brilliant.
Set of videos.
I love that you're about to illustrate your case with an anecdote. Well done.
Yeah, so there's a great set of videos on, you can probably find them on YouTube, of a German car manufacturer. I think it's called something like the Fun Project, where they tried to change people's behaviour. And a good example, very similar to the lift example, was they had an escalator and a set of stairs, and they had time-lapse photography, everyone using the escalator and ignoring the stairs. And then they laid piano steps on the stairs that, when you stood on them, made a piano noise. And suddenly everyone was using the stairs and not the escalator. And so I just wonder whether we should focus the debate on how you change people's behaviour. And I suppose just a question to on that same vein is NLP manipulative?
NLP.
So changing behaviour seems to be in
national.
So we have changing of behaviour versus credibility, it feels, going on here. There were some other hands up.
Yeah.
Who's close?
I've got
a
microphone. Hello, I'm up here.
Oh, up the top.
So there was a couple of things, actually, which is I do think in answer to your Was it right to talk about this as an example of extreme climate change? Yes, it was, because actually you can't prove it's not wrong. And I think this absolute, utter, you know, I must be completely right. It doesn't burn your credibility if you make a mistake. You know, and I think that to the point of changing people's behaviour and getting people bought into any form of argument, you have to be willing to stand up for what you believe. So I'm not a scientist, I should say that, maybe obvious. What I need to do every day to kind of get through my job is explain to them why it's important. I work in IT, everyone thinks I'm a geek. But in order to do it, I have to translate it into a language they can understand. I have to make sure they understand why it's important. And I have to be passionate about what I believe in. And I think that sometimes, as a scientist, you can get caught up in how right you are or how wrong you are. And actually, you should be backing the 80%. I also think, just as a related sidebar, I do think scientists are engaged very much in persuasion, because in order to be a recognised scientist, don't you have to get through a peer review? And at that point, isn't that simply an act of persuasion simply to be published? So isn't it already inherent? It's just got a slightly different nuance within the scientific community.
Cool. All right, let's just move on. See what else is on these slides I've got here. Have I upset people? People want to keep talking about that.
I must be passionate and speak to that point. And I'm sure you're feeling exactly the same, Barry?
Yeah.
I love it. Somebody banged on the table. Isn't that brilliant?
I just can't disagree with you, Bruce.
Well, there is a reality, and then there's something we aspire to. And the point made earlier on about the scientific method is it would be professional suicide to go on a hunch, to back it, and to ignore the fact that everything that we state has to be qualified by the data. The data is never that clean, and there is always the possibility you might be wrong. And that's why we have experiments, because by refining the experiments, we clean up the data and we get closer to the truth, but always approximating towards the truth. We very rarely get there at a level that the general public would like us to be at in order to say something categorically is one thing or the other. So whilst I totally understand your point that it would be great to get straight-speaking scientists saying things in public and sticking to their guns, the reality is that your peers would you'd be fired. So we do have a method that we aspire to, and that is to be as objective as possible. But yeah, we get subjective. But peer review and promotion and getting tenure, these are all based on the assumption that it's objective.
Can I just say something about? I mean, there's a big danger in this that you know, it's as if we're saying, unless scientists come out and say this is absolutely true, or indeed slightly mislead by saying it's conclusive when it's not, the people out there won't understand. Heavens, there's a dangerous assumption there. Look, there are people all over this country who go into betting shops and calculate odds on a level I don't understand and work out exactly what they should do on horses, and when they talk to me about it, it's sort of mind-boggling. That's a level of sophistication. You know, to go and say to people, look, it's a bet and the likelihood and the odds are very high, that's the kind of thing that's going to have an influence on my behaviour vis-a-vis smoking. Whereas if we go for the one example really helps, then we're going to be in the territory you talked about where your granny lived to 100 and smoked like a chimney. You don't want people to take the one example and think, that did it for me. You really do want the bet. And I think we would be in danger of patronising people if we think they can't understand bets. I'm sure they can.
Just quickly, what about the extent to which you have persuaded yourself, right, in terms of representing this, these percentages, right? Scientists deal, I think, in doubt constantly and question things that lots of the rest of us would go, no, that's true, that's fine. That's what science is, right? But what about in terms of employing rhetoric in an interview, in a lecture or whatever, would it be acceptable for a scientist to stand in this room and say, I am entirely persuaded that X is true, that man-made climate change represents a threat and we must act on it? Because there comes a point, I think, where you make your own decision about what you believe, and where you're still a scientist and you can still say in response to the question, the data says that our laboratory is 90%, 80%, whatever, convinced by this, and I am persuaded. So to take ownership, just to try and make the leap that the gentleman was talking about there, because it's different. Science is different from enacting behaviour change, and I wonder whether scientists are the right or the best people to try and bring about behaviour change. Maybe it should be handed to another department.
Can I just come back, really following on from the business about the smoking, which I think is an interesting line to go down, because that did, you know, the work in the 1950s of persuading people, Ash and people like that, had an effect. Okay, it took 50 years, but yeah, you know, has had a huge effect on our society, you know, going to a pub and people aren't smoking, all that kind of thing. And are there lessons that could be learned in terms of climate change and how you put that across? Or is the world now just so different in terms of how it looks at science than perhaps it looked at in the 1950s? You could have a doctor saying, you know, there is this link, when in fact, presumably, it was still a statistical link even then, and it could have been correlated to, I don't know, nuclear weapons or something like that. And even now, presumably, we're not 100%, like we're saying about Uncle Jim who smoked for, you know, 60 years and didn't have lung cancer, and Auntie Rose who had lung cancer and never smoked. I mean, still there are exceptions, so we're still not quite tied down. But I wonder what lessons there were to learn from that model, perhaps.
It comes down
past.
To who shouts loudest, doesn't it? The thing about the tobacco debate, I think, not being old enough to remember, is that the companies knew about the dangers, but they were insistent to the outside world. They said very, very clearly, this does not cause a problem. And the other scientists may well have said, actually, there is a problem. If you're faced with someone who is... What does a scientist do in that situation? You have the who shouts loudest thing, right? We all know about lots of people who shout loudest and they're heard because quite frequently you're fed up with people shouting, so you walk away after that and that's the only opinion you're left with. But in that situation, against who shouts loudest, what does a scientist do to convince these people? Do they, you know... Use anecdotes? Do they put some horrible smell on the leaflets they push through people's doors? You know, what does a scientist do when faced with these people shouting very, very loudly who are wrong? But this comes back to what Felicity was saying, though, about the...
And can I just pick up on this point? Because lessons have been learnt from the tobacco experience. Unfortunately, those lessons have been learnt by the climate change sceptics, who have learnt from what the tobacco industry did for decades, and they are often the same people today, the same organisations, mimicking exactly the same tactics. And the main tactic they use is to spread doubt. So when scientists make statements about... probably this is the case, then the sceptics, and before that the tobacco industry, would home in on that little expression of doubt, turn it around, and therefore say they are not sure about this. They are in doubt. And of course, I mean, we have a language of probability. That's how the law works. And one of the things that always, you know, intrigues me is how can we manage to handle court cases with an understanding of probability and on the balance of probabilities, and yet our public discourse about science completely fails to do the same.
I think because of media responsibility, irresponsibility. I mean, science has shown that, which gets transmitted as a sort of form of words, as opposed to, you know, science has got very good reasons for thinking that. I think one of the things you want to do is encourage scientific journalists who are doing a good job. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of an antagonism between science and the media, thinking, oh, the media misrepresent or simplify or distort. When you see a scientist getting their story well expressed and well communicated, you know, they want to encourage that journalist, tell their editor that was well done. You know, there is a science journalist in the Daily Mail called Fiona McRae, who's actually one of the few science journalists who's got a science degree. And if you read her stories, they're actually pretty good. Mm. So, you know, you want to encourage that, to say this is better practice than something else. And the other thing Marcus said that really matters is we require the media, not the scientists, to find out who's funding the research. Mm. I mean, that's crucial, because you knew that a lot of the counter evidence was coming from the tobacco industry. I mean, just as all this wonderful research that's coming out about resveratrol in red wine having great impacts on you know, the heart and being anti-cancerous is coming out of University of California, Davis, Bordeaux and Dijon. You know, it's not for nothing.
Any more comments from the audience? Do you want to wait for the microphone just so everyone can hear you?
You haven't addressed funding at all. In all of this conversation, you're talking about scientists as if they're altruistic people in some attic using their own money to do these experiments. And we all know it's not like that anymore. Even the universities are going commercial. You know, how can you, you know, how many experiments are still going in the bin? How many experiments, if they don't prove that Kellogg's cornflakes make you have a better day, then that one goes in the bin and we'll get the Daily Mail to write about this one that does work. You know, how much is the scientist is not this altruism, because you've got to get your funding from somewhere. You know, who funds your universities?
There's two things that I think. There are two sources of funding. There are some commercial funders and they face the issues, and the whole Ben Goldacre's thing with Bad Pharma, it deals with that. You know, there is commercial funding for some research and then trials. There's a reason to suppress trials. But there's also something with the normal, most science funding comes from the UK research councils in this country, who are meant to be, you know, they don't have a particular bias in their opinion. They're just giving money to fund the best science. That's what they say. But now all science, when you submit a proposal, it's required that you also submit an impact statement. You have to convince somebody, the research council, that your work has impact. And so in the past, I think it may be true that scientists had a bit more freedom to do what they thought was the most important thing to do. But now, to get money, they are required to convince people that their science has a societal impact that they can't know anything about because it's in the future, it's speculation. But that's the way everyone works, right? If you are better at persuasion, you're better at getting funding. Now, is that a flaw in the way the research councils work, or is that just that scientists have to deal with how society works?
I think it's definitely a flaw, but I also think that the government doesn't do enough independent research. There is no independent research or really encouraged. But also, I think on a different point, and the journalists have the most to play with this, is statistics are, which is my, I'm a mathematician, it's the easiest way to make anything seem important or seem absolutely unimportant. If I told you there was a disease that killed 900 people a year, a lot of you might go, oh, that's terrible. If I said, well, that's in the whole world and there's 6 billion people in the world, it's absolutely insignificant, you go, oh, but that's fine. If I said, well, actually, all of those 600 people lived in a particular area around this, then suddenly it's significant again. You know, the way you manipulate the population makes the statistics significant or not significant. And so often, that just the media, they want the punchline. They want the 600 people die each year of this. They don't want to explain that actually that's 600 in the whole world, it's nothing, or that's 600 people who live thousands of miles away from hospitals and medical equipment. You know, it's this sort of stuff isn't explained properly. Today on Radio 4, I heard for the first time ever, they gave a statistic and then they said something like, and the scientists behind this believe that this is not insignificant because of, and they actually gave the warning, which if you see any documentation on, say, selling you insurance or whatever, there's all of the fine print about how, you know, well, this could not be, maybe not. If you go to America and you listen to an advertisement for a drug that they have on TV, you know, are you feeling down?
The warnings go on for a long time. You know,
and Marcus had a point. And they read out the fine print, you know.
It was only briefly that, as well as full implementation of Leveson, I would also, and his recommendations, I would also love to see the press, all media, in fact, have to state who funded the research first. In research carried out by Kellogg's, they found most people think cornflakes are quite nice. Would mean most newspapers would drop down to around 3 pages, which would also satisfy me. It'd just make my job a lot easier because it'd be quicker. But, you know, the boffins have found, according to new research and all the rest of it. It's amazing how receptive people are to that. I made a spoof history documentary years ago, and we walked into an Asda, actually. That was the first one we did in Bedminster, and we said, according to new research, a group of local enthusiasts now believe this is where Boadicea fought the Romans. Could we reenact that battle in Asda, in the bread aisle? And they said yes. Because, and partly because we had cameras, which has an impact, but we did say, we started by saying, according to new research, it's amazing how much weight those few words, according to new research, carries. It's incredible. So I agree with you in essence.
Where it's more comments or questions. One at the top there, yep.
I wrote a book that's called Rhetoric of Law, and it has the parallel question, is it with law that makes it persuasive? And my suggestion is that we have to follow the media, what kind of media law is communicated through, and what kind of media science is communicated through. So the text-based media will have a text-based rhetoric. And the other, if you look at the university, how a university communicates through robes and through rooms like this, through rituals and all these other regimes of expression will have their own type of rhetoric. But the bottom line will always be like the wolf boy, that you will have a kind of rhetorical economy that you can sometimes use up your credibility, and other times you can build up your credibility, and that's like human life.
So,
I wanted some water.
You want some water? he's got his water. Someone was persuaded. Over where have we got microphone? Where are the microphones? No. Over there, up there.
Hi. I think Helen made a very good point that scientists have to deal with the way that society works. And the fact is, the way society works is that people's attention is got by dramatic events and dramatic statistics. And I'm thinking in particular of safety examples. So, for example, after the Titanic sank, I'm sure there was somebody saying, I've been telling you for ages we should have enough lifeboats for everybody. And I think that's how behaviour change is driven. It's dramatic events and statistics that get people's attention. And I also wonder, going back to the lift example, if you had two lifts and on one of the lifts you put a bunch of yellow and black tape, left it open and had smoke coming out of it, how many people would want to use the other lift then?
So should scientists adapt to them, to adopt the norms of society, or do we as scientists still have something different, right? We think of ourselves as aiming for objective truth, whatever that is, something objective, and traditionally scientists have slightly held themselves above the fray and kind of gone, well, we're better than that, I think. Or do we just have to deal with society and the fact that we're all flawed, we're all human beings, and fundamentally, if it's either an explosion or a kitten, we'll go for it?
Well, I think that's a very dangerous road to tread. And we've seen in my field recently a number of outings of scientists who've been fraudulent in an attempt to be dramatic. And so we have to be wary that the incentives that you place to make people do these, to make these claims, are dangerous. But I would also just kind of concur with that whole idea about if you don't make impact, you're never really going to progress. And I can just tell you that we had a meeting a couple of years back, which was funded by one of the research councils, the ESRC, about how to take our science and make an impact into policy making. And it was to be hosted, we were to have a politician, an MP, turn up, and he was going to tell us about this. And of course, we all turned up with great expectation that our basic research was going to be translated into application. And basically, he canceled and didn't bother and then sent along an underling. And they said, well, you know what? If it doesn't make the front page of the Daily Mail, then it's never really going to come across their table. So there is this sort of, you know, this perception that unless you're really, you know, kicking up a big fuss, but that in itself has an inherent danger for sensationalism.
I think we probably have one more, now half past eight, so we probably have one more question then wrap up. We'll have one up there.
In some ways, in order to assess argument, we have to be able to understand the science. And I would argue that in some ways we are doing that. Events like this, and actually television programmes now, are, including ones that you appear in, are explaining in simple terms to the public these concepts of climate change, of the planet, the David Attenborough programmes where they show you all the nature and then they show you how climate change is affecting that. I would argue that there is an attempt now to try and get people to understand the science and that that then helps to them to assess these persuasive techniques and draw their own conclusions.
The problem is not everyone watches science TV.
No, they do.
OK, I'm going to give each of our panellists a chance to say anything that they have left over to say. We'll start with Barry. Have you got any comments?
I just wanted to kind of underline this point. You said people are saying things in simple terms. As long as we don't confuse simple with easy, simple is hard. Simple is to boil something down and keep the integrity and the content of it, but make it transparent and available to people. That's a real skill, so we should find people like Helen who can do this and support them and promote them. Second thing is that to speak up a little bit from the research councils, although there's a lot of pressure to have impact, sitting on research councils lately, they have said they're very worried that they aren't getting very innovative suggestions and that what's actually happening is that a lot of the researchers worried about getting money and showing impact are playing it safe. So we need to somehow provide an environment where you give people the opportunity to fail and fail better, because that's how you progress and that's how you learn.
Felicity.
I think I want to return to a point made briefly before about who is it we mean by scientists, what do we mean by science, and that science doesn't speak with one voice. And what we've been debating today, there's sort of been a bit underneath there an assumption about controlling public discourse, and I think that's one thing we need to relax a bit about, that we're never going to control it entirely, and who we are is in any case problematic.
Bruce?
I would just speak up for scientists as a scientist. We're motivated by passion, curiosity, I think virtues. And it's really unfortunate that we seem to be perceived sometimes as being duplicitous, uncertain, manipulative. And I think that we do need to work harder sometimes just to convince the general public that we're in it because we love it.
Marcus?
I think for people who seriously question and undermine scientific research, which has been honest about its funding, I think there need to be far greater consequences. I think that, for example, Melanie Phillips should have her microwave taken away. Because there is this weird double standard that exists where people will say, well, I mean, these boffins, these scientists, I don't trust scientists, but our houses are full. Our lives are full of the things that have been given to us by people who've been willing to make leaps. And I think those things should be taken away from people who disagree with me.
So no Luddites on Twitter, basically, is the message there. I feel as a, research scientists find this very difficult, I think, and the key to this whole thing is being open about what we think, being transparent about what we know and what we don't know and what we're trying to do, because it seems the greatest crime of all is to manipulate by hiding information, and that we may not be doing the best job we can do all the time, but as long as we're aware of the issues and we're willing to learn and to engage in debates like this, then at least we'll do better next time. And I think that's an important thing. We have to be, failure is going to happen, but we have to be open and willing to learn and admit that we could do better. And so I'm happy to... It's been really interesting to hear all these different opinions and all these sort of different takes on it. There will be an audio recording of this available from the Pod Delusion and possibly later on the RI channel, depending on how the technology bit works. If you're one of the people, this is the first time you've been in the RI, you can become a member of this place. There's sort of information and leaflets and things are downstairs, or you can look on the website. There's lots of things going on here, so please consider getting involved in those. And there's clearly lots still to discuss, and for those who are interested, that will be happening in the pub next door. So probably downstairs in the basement. So thank you very, very much for turning up. Great stuff.
And that's it. Thanks for listening to this special podcast recording from the Faraday Lecture Theatre at the Royal Institution. You can find links to the Royal Institution on the Poddelusion website, as well as our interview with Dr. Helen Zirsky on episode 173 of the Poddelusion. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Thanks for listening.